This is Jim Fossone from VeteransRadio.net, broadcasting from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. We want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. Also, we'd like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. Until then, let's take it back to Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We're really excited today to speak to our guest, retired Lieutenant Colonel Mark McCurley, whose book, Hunter Killer, is one of the first looks inside America's unmanned air war. Colonel, say hello to the Veterans Radio listening audience.
Okay. Well, hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
We're glad to have you, Colonel. Just to give folks a little bit of background, I know you were a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy, and you've had time both in the seat as a pilot and as an intelligence operator. Why don't you give us a little bit about those first early years of your service to the country before you got into the RPA, or Remotely Piloted Aircraft Program?
Okay. I spent my early years when I first got commissioned as a combat interrogator. It was a role the Air Force had up until about 1995. And as that wound down, I transferred over to pilot training, where I flew in pretty much all the reconnaissance aircraft, or at least touched them. Did a couple of tours flying pilot training for the Air Force, and it was in my second tour flying T-6s that I learned I was going into another non-combat job, and this was in 2003. At that time, I volunteered for the Predator program because it was the quickest way to get into combat and see what I could do to support my country.
So this is at that time in 2003. Tell us a little bit about the Predator and what the state of affairs were in the remote piloted aircraft, or we'll call it RPA program, was in 2003.
Okay, well, the state was pretty poor. The airplane was first introduced in 1993. Neil Bluer, General Atomics, had a vision of disabling the communist army in Nicaragua during the Sandinista affair in the 80s by flying an airplane with explosives into their POL tanks, and thereby, no gas, no drive. He brought that home with him when he moved back to the United States, bought General Atomics, and directed them to build me an unmanned airplane. And the Predator is what they introduced in 93. The Air Force bought it in 95. And just a couple of years later, it started flying combat. And the thing is we look at the pilot community, Air Force pilots, Navy pilots, we all think in a similar way. We think of the guy wearing the leather jacket, the 6-foot silk scarf, flying an open cockpit, real old school flying. We still kind of envision ourselves that way. And when the airplane came out, the operators looked at it as a sitting in a box or sitting in an airplane with a big wraparound window. I don't think the airplane. Intel, on the other side, took a look at the airplane and they saw huge potential in its targeting pod, as far as behind the lines, intelligence gathering, things like that. And so they bought the airplane. Initially, the Air Force didn't put a lot of quality guys into the aircraft. There were a lot of the guys that were, flunkies from the individual weapon systems, and sit there to kind of die in the vine rather than send a better pilot. And unfortunately, that tainted the community and what they could do. When September 11th happened, these guys were thrust back into combat, and they didn't do very well. The Army didn't know what to do with them. The crews, if they checked in with the guys on the ground, did it unprofessionally. And so when I volunteered for the program, the state wasn't in a very good place. Myself, along with several guys from the training classes around me, we all got together and said, this has got to be fixed. And we worked really hard to do that. And the results of the effort of a whole bunch of people in this program has really turned it around and turned into what we see today.
Well, certainly the successes that the RPA program has had has also convinced, I'm sure, all the detractors about the importance of the RPA program and the pilots and the crews that work with them. But let's go back to 2003 and talk a little bit about the training one had to do to learn how to fly these remotely piloted aircraft. Was the training program as robust and maybe sophisticated as I would think about for other airframes?
Yes, it was. The design of the training program is just like any other tactical aircraft. You fly a short series of sorties to learn how to fly the airplane, do the basic piloting skills, and you get your qualification check. Then you go into the mission phase, and you fly a number of sorties learning all the different things that we can do with the airplane, and then receive a mission check with it. Very similar formula to all the other aircraft. It might have been a little bit of a shorter program than others just because we didn't have very many missions at the time. But as far as the quality of training, the training was very good.
The one of the things I think folks are maybe a little confused on is that there are all sorts of different types and sizes of RPAs, or more commonly known in the general public as drones. But from a military standpoint, can you tell us a little bit about the Predator, which is one of the many RPAs that you flew?
Sure. The Air Force calls the Predator an RPA, remotely piloted aircraft, because it's flown by licensed pilots. The airplane itself is a full-size aircraft with the basic equipment it needs to fly in the National Airspace System. The Predator is the same size as a Cessna 182. The bigger MQ-9 Reaper is the size of an A-10 fighter, and it carries about as much ordnance as an F-16. So these are much bigger aircraft than people think of when they think of a drone. And a drone being like the little quadcopter you see the hobbyist flying in the park or something like that. And those airplanes, you have very little control over them. If something breaks, they crash. But for our aircraft, we sit in an actual cockpit that has a stick, a throttle, and rudder pedals. So push the stick forward, cows get big. Pull stick back, cows get small. And we fly by the same principles. The only difference is when I move the control stick, instead of a wire taking my signal to the computer on the airplane and figuring out how to move the flight controls, I have this radio data link that separates my controls to the computer on the airplane. It's a slight difference, but in the end, we still fly with the same amount of controls we do in another aircraft.
So I think that helps people realize how big these things are, both the Predator and the Reaper, and I think you had the opportunity to fly both of those planes, didn't you?
I do, yes.
Now, the Air Force has the Predators. Who had the Reaper?
Right now, that's just the Air Force, although they had a version of it called the BAMS-D that the Navy flew for a while. They may still fly it. I'm not really sure, but they stopped the program for a short period of time there.
Can you talk to us a little bit, and we're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Mark McCurley, retired, who has a book out called Hunter Killer, Inside America's Unmanned Air War. And I was wondering, Mark, if you could tell us a little bit about the engines and how these things fly.
Well, the technology is very much the same as any other aircraft, with the exception of the cockpit, as I mentioned before. It's when I fly a normal airplane, a manned aircraft, I can feel and sense so much around me. I know the air flowing around the wings. I can feel the resistance when I move the stick. I can hear the hum of the engines or the whine if it's a jet. And I know if something goes wrong, if there's a hiccup, and misses a cylinder or something like that. When I fly a Predator, it's not the same. While the basic control of the airplane is the same, I don't feel anything. I don't hear anything. All I can do is see what's on my HUD in front of me, my heads-up display. It's a military standard HUD with the flight instruments that you expect in any manned airplane. But the difference is, instead of feeling like, say, a sink rate develop as I come in to land, so I don't want to land too hard, I want to make it nice and even, I can't feel that, but I have to sense it by watching. And that takes a little while for guys to adjust. The guys that do the best are the ones that have a lot of experience. The guys that don't have a lot of experience, sometimes they struggle, but after a dozen rides or so, the differences start to kind of melt away. And then once you're involved in the missions, you forget that you're sitting in a box instead of a cockpit inside the airplane. You're still on site with these guys, talking to them on the radio and watching what goes on around them and doing your best to take care of them.
So one of the things I learned from your reading Hunter Killer, your book, was some of the other RPAs that are out there and I didn't really know much about or how they were used. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Pioneer and also Scan Eagle, which I had never heard of before.
Okay, well, the Predator, once it it really got rolling in Iraq, we had one instance where one of our fighter pilots decided one day that he didn't want to just show up on a site and provide video footage. He decided to check in like he was a fighter pilot and gave him the standard brief that all the ground controllers expect. And it turns out the unit that he was checking in with was under fire. They're about to be overrun, and they were begging for air support. And he just happened to be there. 5 minutes later, he had unloaded all his weapons, and those guys were going home alive. And I mean, that's an amazing experience, but what it did was kind of sparked a change in how we were used in theater. And it changed the perception. The Army looked at it as, wow, these things are really, really useful. They're not just eyes in the sky, but they can actually be used for CAS and used for other means to protect our troops, but also, help out with raids and things. And the demand started to grow. And it grew so rapidly that even the meteoric growth of the Predator program could not keep up. The other services bought their own. The Shadow and Pioneer aircraft were old Israeli unmanned aircraft built back in the 80s. I think that's when they first started being produced. And they're small, about the size of your desk. You can consider them an RPA vice drone because they do have a guy at the flight controls flying, but they didn't have weapons. They were good for surveillance, but they were kind of loud, so they weren't quiet like our airplane, and it would burn a target. The Scan Eagle was an answer to that. Another contractor, I forget which at the moment, developed this, and it was another small aircraft that they flew around to provide surveillance and imagery. And these aircraft, while they didn't have weapons, they still did amazing things to protect the troops. And one of the stories I talk about with the Pioneers is, when I was in Fallujah with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force, I got to visit the squadron there and watch how they did things. And they flew very similar to how the Predator does. In our technology, we launch and land in theater with a line of sight transmitter. When it gets up to altitude, we'll switch it to satellite and give it to a crew back here in the United States. The Pioneer is much in the same way, except they don't have satellite. So they take off, they fly to a certain point, and then they hand the airplane over to another radio transmitter, say in Ramadi, and then they fly the airplane over Ramadi. At the time, the forward operating base Ramadi was just getting shelled all the time by mortars. And since they couldn't really use these airplanes for raids, they fly them overhead all the suspected sites where guys are launching. And if they're overhead and the guys launch something, we went and got the guys. The insurgents knew that, so whenever it flew, they stopped they stopped being active. And in essence, we turned these airplanes into area denial weapons. They couldn't take action, but it just their presence made people stop.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting insights, listeners, you'll get from reading Hunter Killer by Lieutenant Colonel Mark McCurley, is you give us some sense of how different RPAs are utilized differently in theater, so that, you're protecting and watching the troops, and your tactics change because of maybe the skills or the attributes of the different RPAs. So it was a fascinating read. I want to back you up to the Predator. I got off on that other little tangent that I was interested in. Let me back you up to the Predator flying. Tell us a little bit about, the normal altitude that you operate at, the sort of the range, the length of ships, that sort of stuff. Take us inside flying a Predator.
Well, of course, I can't get into too many specifics about the technical capabilities, but these airplanes, they're flying all the time. One little known fact is, of all the military aircraft in the world, only one has been flying at all times since September 11th, and that's the Predator. We have airplanes all over the world flying in combat. And we fly, 24-hour days, launching, landing, flying missions, doing the whole nine yards. And it can be kind of drudge work, if you will. We'll wake up, we'll drive 45 minutes to get to work, transition from being someone's daddy to being a warrior, sit in the cockpit and fly for 8 hours. And if it's an easy day, we don't do anything. We just watch and collect intelligence. If it's a hard day, then we'll have to pull a trigger and deal with the consequences of that. And at the end of the day, we still go home. And the mix is very different from the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who have to deploy to the theater and they fight outside the water. For them, the fight is much more visceral, engages all the senses, and it's much more horrific. For us, it does back us off a little bit. We are 8,000 miles away. But our cameras are high definition, and we have the ability to get up close and personal. One of the shots that I took against an Al-Qaeda facilitator. In the last couple of seconds time of flight, I had to get really low to get underneath some leather to take the shot. And I was so close to him that when he heard the missile come in, he turned and looked right at me through the camera. And I looked him in the eyes the last couple of moments of his life. And all that filled my head was his face. That's pretty intimate. Even if I'm not physically there, it's still very intimate watching that and knowing that what I'm seeing is not Hollywood special effects, but it's an action that I took by pulling that trigger.
Well, I think one of the things that the book, again, kind of gets across to everybody is that there are a lot of hours flown, a lot of, I think you, in your language, mind-numbing shifts involved until you get to those sort of situations. Did the other crew that work with you, maybe you can talk a little bit about the crew that's involved, just in flying, but the whole process of keeping it up and using the intelligence that's associated with an RPA?
Well, what makes the Predator so special is the support team behind it. When we look at an airplane, we see, okay, there's two guys flying, the pilot and the sensor operator who works the weapons. But it's so much more than that. We have an intelligence team, about 100 guys per mission, doing just intelligence to watch what we're doing, to analyze the information, to collect, analyze, and process all that stuff. Other aircraft, a lot of times they fly, they take off, they take their intelligence, and it's not until they get home that some of this stuff is processed. And with our growing technology, it's becoming less and less, but for the most part, because of how we're structured and being on the ground, I can have those intel officers sitting next to me saying, hey, can you look at that? Can you go over there? And who's that person walking over there? What are they doing? And I can't do that with a manned airplane very easily. And that gives us a sense of flexibility that even though a lot of what we do is kind of boring, because circling targets while they're just stationary can be boring, the reality is we collect so much better information, I think, than so many folks because of this added capability of having folks with us in the cockpit.
So the persons or the folks sitting with you in the cockpit were the sensor operators?
Yes. Usually I only had one person in the cockpit, and that would be the sensor operator. He works the targeting pod and the lasers. I fire the missiles, and I fly the aircraft itself. And as a team, it's like a two-seat fighter. I had the pilot up front and the weapon system operator in the back, and it's essentially that sort of relationship. But in our operations cell and in other places, near us, we had all these intel analysts that could come and talk to us directly or talk to us through the intercom as if they are in the airplane with us.
That's what I was trying to get to you. So it's you and the sensor operator kind of in the plane, if you want to look at it that way. But in real time, somewhere else, there's a whole bunch of intelligence officers gathered looking at all the information that's being gathered by the Predator.
And they're deeply integrated with us so they can talk to us real time and we can meet their needs real time. If they need us to shift to a target or shift to support troops or, follow a person, it's a lot easier to talk to us than it is a fighter who's trying to do the same thing for his targeting pod.
So, and we're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Mark McCurley, who's the author of Hunter Killer. Colonel, tell us a little bit about the sensor operators, sort of what training they go through, what are these enlisted guys or officers, men, women? What's the relationship with the sensor operators?
They are young enlisted airmen. They go through the same rigorous training as the pilots do, whereas the pilots are learning how to fly the airplane, take off, land, and do the piloting skills. The sensors, at the same time, are learning how to work the targeting pod and all of its features. And once we get past the basic skill tests, we get married up as a crew, and then we learn all the missions together. So from start to finish, we both get very extensive training that complements each other.
And do you fly with the same operators all the time, or is this a rotating basis? How does it work?
No, we don't fly with the same guys each time. It would be nice sometimes because it's easy to anticipate when you're a team. But the reality is as we get so many orbits out there and so many guys, you'll factor in someone goes sick for a day or goes on vacation, and you just can't down a bunch of guys because half their crews are on vacation. So we mix it up. It's different. We learn a lot from each guy that we fly with, and ultimately I think that complements what we do.
And you had assignments flying the Predators or overseeing other squads that we're both stationed here in the continental United States, but also these things are operated overseas as well.
Correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that occurs?
Well, we have an extensive architecture of supervision over our aircraft. And this is true for any military unit, really. It's our chain of command. But we have a wing operations center at Creech that oversees all the squadrons, whether they're overseas or stateside. And they're kind of an added layer of protection before you get up to the general officer level as to making sure that the guys are compliant with the rules of engagement, law of armed conflict, things like that. And we're also a clearinghouse of information to make sure that the crews have what they need to do their mission.
Colonel, you had some, you were there during sort of a critical period of time flying from, I think, what, 2003 to about 2012?
Yeah, I left the program in 2012. I volunteered for it in 2003.
So one of the missions you talk about in your book is sort of the spotting, possibly, of Osama bin Laden. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, sure. That was 2004, still fairly early in the war for what we were doing. Emotions were still high in the States. You know, everybody's focus was find UBL. And on that particular day, we were flying from our base to a very distant target. It's several hours for us to cruise to get to it. So rather than just waste our time, we decided, hey, let's look at the ground, see what we can find. As we go along, so we might find something of value that can help the guys out on the ground. And we came across a man with three guards walking through the wilderness. And it's the same bouldery, rocky wilderness with the pine trees that you see in all these videos from the early 2000s. And we looked at him as a very tall guy, taller than everyone around him, dressed the same as we see in all the videos. He had guards dressed in black with their weapons. And giving him a lot of space and a lot of respect. And we looked at that and watched him for a while and said, that looks very familiar. He has the same manner of walking, the same cane, the same physical features. And the guys around him react much as we see him in the videos. So we called it into our intelligence analysts who, at the time, were not online because we were cruising. That, you know, they were taking a break. And so we pulled them back in. They watched him for over an hour and make the decision that this is, in fact, Osama bin Laden. So we start our checklist to do something about it, whether it's a capture or a kill. And this falls under our rules of engagement, which, of course, are procedures that define, you know, not just the legalities of what we do, but the procedures and any restrictions that are placed on us by the nations that we work with. And as we follow this rules of engagement, which are more strict for Predator, by the way, than manned airplanes, somewhere up the chain, one of the supervision level individuals decided that there wasn't enough information to take a shot, and ended up calling us off. And they never really admitted why, but one of the things that was still fairly strong in the community's mind was that 2 years prior, I think it was a manned airplane, dropped a bomb on someone that was identified as Osama bin Laden. Turns out it was a farmer and his sons. And so, of course, that was still very fresh in the minds of the military leadership, and especially the political leadership of the Air Force. And so somewhere along the lines, someone decided there wasn't enough information or they couldn't confirm that it truly was the target, and so they elected not to engage.
Well, this was a spotting in 2004. Osama bin Laden was finally captured and killed in 2011. Interesting to think about how history might have been changed if it had occurred. But there were other high-profile missions that you found yourself in the middle of, including the American-born terrorist cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that particular mission.
Yeah, that's probably our most controversial one so far. My unit deployed to Djibouti for the specific mission of hunting him down. At the time, diplomatically, the nation of Yemen would not allow us to deploy troops there to conduct capture operations. So the burden of the operation fell on the shoulders of the Predator for an airstrike. And it took us about a year working the networks and mapping out who's who in Yemen and finally figuring out not only who Awlaki was, but where he was operating. And we were able to track him from that point on. The strike itself, it took a while to coordinate. We watched him for 3 days while we worked these rules of engagement. because of how high profile it was, the decision had to go all the way to the president for action. And in the book, we talk about how we only had about 10 minutes to take the shot once the approval was given. And what we did, you know, in the spirit of the rules of engagement, was to try to hit him between villages as he was traveling. You know, that way there'd be no collateral damage. It'd only be him and his Al-Qaeda guards. And that's how we ended up striking him. The decision came through just as he was entering this valley between the excuse me, I'm sorry.
Well, as you read the book on this, it's interesting how much time the Predator program and others like it go into understanding the daily habits of the bad guys and finding the right spot or right way upon confirmation to make a strike. And it sounds like that's part of what was done in this particular instance.
Absolutely. Everything we do is terribly intimate, even if we're 8,000 miles away. We watch the war in high definition through our cameras, and we really get to know these guys. We know when they wake up, when they go to bed, what they do when they're at work. We know when their families are home and where they go. We know absolutely everything about them. So when the decision comes for a kill or a capture, it's kind of personal for us, more so if you actually have to do the job yourself. Because you know so much about them.
Well, one of the other things that is sort of unique of the RPAs is that you could put them into situations that you might not have put pilots and planes at risk, both because of the human element, and there's a huge cost differential going on here as well. And that sort of factored in a little bit to the rescue efforts to help out Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell in about 2005. Can you tell us a little bit about that that mission?
Absolutely. That was, to me, the highlight of my career. You know, we see in the news all the strikes and things like that. That's the big headline-generating sorties. But it's the behind-the-scenes, the humanitarian stuff that we do that's really more important to me. When SEAL Team 5 went down, it happened just a couple hours before I came in work. So as I walk into our operations cell, it is a flurry of activity. Guys are everywhere on the phone, running around, doing a lot more stuff than they usually are at the end of the shift. And so, of course, I knew something was up. And we sit down for the briefing to find out the mission. And they look at me and it's like, Mark, you're going in. SEAL Team is down, and we need you to find them. And I knew then, I was like, wow, this is very serious, because any American out there who's in distress, we're going to go find them. That's our goal, bring them all home alive. As we start our mission, we're the only ones flying in Afghanistan at the point. There's a line of thunderstorms coming through and just destroying. These are massive state-sized thunder cells. You're just destroying the countryside. So the manned aviation can't go support. The choppers that went to rescue the SEAL team, one had been shot down, the other had returned to base, and so it was up to us to get through. And we sent three airplanes. The first two got knocked down by the thunderstorms, and mine just happened to, by sheer luck, get through. And when we got to the other side, we got there in time to see the burning wreckage of the Chinook that had tried to rescue. And we stayed on station looking for Marcus. And we watched and watched and watched. And by the time we made contact with him, he didn't actually make contact with us, but he tried to talk on a radio looking for help. And he called at the time he's supposed to for the procedure. He's whispering to his handset because he didn't want to be overheard by people that were hunting him. But we heard him, and I heard his call sign. And it's one of those things, I mean, even today, it still kind of sends chills down my back. As I'm flying this way, it's like, where is this guy? I'm looking in these woods. I see all the hot spots from the firefight. Where are these guys? And when I hear that voice, just that plaintive whisper in the darkness, you know, it gets to you. So we used that information to triangulate his position in the village that he took refuge, and use that to corroborate other information to help rescue him.
Well, and listeners, Colonel McCurley here just short-circuited a really riveting portion of his book, Hunter Killer, and the two earlier predators that went down, they're flying into this massive thunderstorm, and those planes go down, and you tell us in quite some good gripping detail about looking for a hole to punch through in this thing so you can get on the other side of the weather. And again, this is one of those situations where you have to think maybe you could put an RPA into that situation, and you certainly wouldn't have put a manned aircraft into that situation.
That's correct. If we put a manned aircraft in that, there's a chance if he goes down, now you have another search and rescue operation in bad weather to deal with. In our case, while there's not enough of our airplanes around to support everybody, we're still going to say, you know what, it's expendable, it's unmanned, get it there, save the American life.
Do you feel the pressure when you're flying in that sort of situation, Colonel? Does your sensor operator and the rest of the team, everybody feeling that pressure?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as a commander, I always told the ground units that I supported, my goal in life is to make sure all your boys come home alive. That's what we do. And so when there's someone in distress, you have a lot of stress on you because you want to bring him home alive. But even beyond that, just the flight aspect, yes, I'm sitting in a box, I'm 8,000 miles away. But when you're flying, you're immersed in that mission, you're talking on the radio to the guys on the ground, you're watching what the airplane is doing, and you're deeply involved in this mission, you forget that your cockpit is not physically attached to the airplane. You feel like you're overhead. And so, yes, the stress is the same. You're just not in danger.
And I guess that's one of the misconceptions I wanted to maybe clear up for listeners, that as pilot or part of the RPA team here with the Predator, you're under all that pressure, you're feeling the mental stress of that, and then you have this really weird thing that goes on, which is the day ends, and now what do you do?
And that's very unique for us. When you're in theater, you end of the day, you go to your bunk in your tent or your prefab building or something like that. When I was with the Marines, my quarters was a tool shed with no door and a moldy mattress. And I think that was the penthouse suite for the location I was at. So we're definitely not like the guys in theater. But, for us, when we do a combat action, there's always a mental price to be paid when you take a life. And no sane person wants to kill. But that's what our job is sometimes. And the guys in theater, they have to get over it real quick because they still have a job to do. But they also sometimes have a lot of time, like months, maybe weeks, to come to grips with something they had to do before they come home. The Predator guys, on a much lower level stress scale, I wake up as a 5-year-old's daddy. I kiss them goodbye. I get in my car, drive 45 minutes to my work location, and hop in the cockpit and fly a combat sortie around the world. On a good day, I do nothing but intelligence stuff. On a hard day, I'll have to pull a trigger. And instead of having a couple of weeks or sometimes they're mulled over or talk about it or come to grips with what happened after seeing it in high def, I get back in the car, drive it 45 minutes, and by the time I get home, I have to be that happy-go-lucky, all joking daddy, ready to play with the kids and kind of push it out of my mind.
We certainly have talked in Veterans Radio before about this emotional stress that remote piloted aircraft teams face, and that we shouldn't underplay the stress that folks are being put into in that situation. Does the service recognize that? Does it provide the pilots and the team members a sort of available chaplains and counselors and others maybe necessary to help you carry that emotional burden?
Oh, yes, they do. It's not the same burden as a guy in a firefight because that's so much more visceral and horrific. Well, what the Predator guys go through is much more low grade. It's a death by a thousand cuts because they have to fly every day for years on end with very few breaks, very little vacation time. They're always in the cockpit on any given day because that's our job. We're there to support the ground troops. And while an individual event may not be traumatic, but over time, enough of them wears the guys down. And so there's a great support structure with the Air Force to help the guys come to terms with that because they find exhaustion just as much as anything else.
Well, and you relate an incident following the deadly shot to, and you referenced earlier the name of him, called him the facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of us would agree that a cigar and a martini at the end may be a good way to deal with the stress and the relaxation as well of that instance. But that is something that you had a little difficulty with on the ride home, trying to make that transition from warrior to regular person that maybe the neighbors don't even know what you do.
And that is unique. Because in theater, you know that it's him or me. And in my case, it wasn't ever going to be me because I was so far away. But when I'm surrounded by, people, they're all warriors. They're all guys who do this for a living. Whereas driving home, like we do in The Predator, I'm surrounded by a bunch of people who don't even realize they're next to a guy who killed somebody. And that was unique. And it's weird because this wasn't my first kill. But it was so much more intimate because all I saw in that HUD as he died was that face looking right back at me. You know, and for some reason that shook me more than the others. But, you know, it's one of those things that we have to deal with. And, you know, the next day I had to move on. There's another sortie to fly, another objective to go after. So I had to get over it real quick.
Colonel, you had a statistic, I think it might even have been in the epilogue of the book, that I thought really helped me put this in perspective if I understood it right. So I'm going to ask you about it, and okay, maybe you can comment on it to our listeners. And if I read it right, in 2011, the Air Force flew 500,000 hours of remote piloted aircraft, and it flew 48,000, so less than a tenth of flight hours were in what I'll call regular planes. Did I read that right?
Sort of. The Predator stat is correct. The 48,000 is just for air combat command. That's the tactical fighters and reconnaissance airplanes. But that's excluding the airlift operations and other commands throughout the Air Force that fly. So just comparing between the different types of combat airplanes, all the others combined flew far less hours than what we flew. And we're a very small cadre of guys.
That, again, I think for most listeners to Veterans Radio and the general public, we'd be shocked to find out that remote piloted aircraft flew 10 times as many hours as the Air Combat Command flights. So I think that's, again, helps us understand and be thankful for all the work that the folks in the Predator program and others like that are doing. Tell us a little bit. I mean, you've got to be pretty proud about how it went from sort of being a joke, I think you referred to it as a joke in the book, in 2003, to being this really vitally important part of the defense of our country. Give us the bigger picture on how you see that fitting together.
Well, unmanned aircraft are the future of aviation. The Predator, while it started out really soft in its impact on the world, there was a small cadre of guys, you know, that I was lucky to be part of that really changed how America fights wars. You know, you look how we're integrated in every operation out there. But there's so much more that we can do. You know, Neil Blue's vision when he built his airplane, you know, became so much more. And it kind of is one of the major pioneering aspects of aviation, forcing people to look at, it's not just people in the cockpit, but it's people in an airplane, whether the cockpit's attached or not, and what can we do with it. We're seeing commercial applications all over the place. You know, Amazon.com is real popular for their package delivery that they're testing, but also the possibility of making unmanned cargo and really reducing the cost of delivery. You know, that may not be in the very near future, but that's something that guys are going to look at. And that's going to change how we look at aviation in general. It pushes that next level of development. And I'm proud to be part of a program that had a hand in that.
Well, it's a fascinating history of roughly that 10 years where that program matured and grew up. Anybody who's an aviation enthusiast, anybody who's maybe doing hobbyist drones and want to find out what the big boys do, there's a lot of people who ought to go out and read Hunter Killer by Lieutenant Colonel Mark McCurley, Inside America's Unmanned Air War. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about where folks can find this book and where they can find and follow you. I know you have recently written a couple of good articles, so tell us a little bit about how people can follow you.
Okay, well, the book is in stores now, so any bookstore should carry it. You can also find it online at any number of sites, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, or any of those sites. For me, I have my own website, markmccurley.net, and I'm also on Twitter at markmccurley.
Well, I think you're going to find a lot of people interested in what you have to say, not only looking back at this 10-year period, but on a going-forward basis. All too often, people talking about certain subjects don't have any real experience with it, so we hope you continue your advocacy in this area talking about the issues that people ought to think about in setting up programs. I see that you recently wrote in Politico an article about your 11 years as an RPA warrior. So I expect you're probably going to be doing some more of that, aren't you?
Well, I sure hope so.
Well, it's been great talking to you here on Veterans Radio. We've been talking to Lieutenant Colonel Mark McCurley, retired from the United States Air Force. His book, Hunter Killer, is available. I want to thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.